most original and creative talent in our business. Would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. I'm here joined with Kathy Fuller Seely, Terry Phillips, John Henderson. You noticed over the weeks we sort of do the intro shorter and shorter, but this one I don't want us to present too long because I want to get right into the Welles meets Welles. What we're doing today is, it's a very famous interview that a lot of you maybe have heard parts of. Some of you maybe have heard the whole thing. But this is Orson Welles meets H.G. Welles. And this is done 2 years after the presentation of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds that we'll also be presenting some point this week. And I just thought it would be neat to get our impression of Welles meets Welles. This is the version, the one that's out there usually is called Part One. And Part One runs about 7 minutes long, and it's on YouTube multiple places. This version, where we have the entire interview, which I think the last part of the interview is, to me, is really interesting. They talk about the war. It's not the part that you hear, which makes sense, is the part about the War of the Worlds, because that's the thing that people are interested in. But I think hearing these two really intelligent gentlemen talk about the war and what's going on and everything is really interesting as well. So I like that we have that. So this is a 24-minute piece of them being interviewed and talking to each other. Let's just go around the horn here and see what we folks think of it or what they notice that they like to talk about. We'll start with my friend John. So go ahead, John. What did you think of this? You heard it many times before, I think.
Yeah, I actually hadn't heard it. I think I heard a clip from it very briefly one time. I had never heard the whole thing, definitely. Very interesting. On a superficial level, it sounds very unique because everybody has such interesting voices. The announcer is that sort of classic stilted 1940s announcer. Yes. And then, of course, Orson Welles always has that distinctive voice, you know, but H.G. Welles, like it seems like a character, like, oh, thank you for having me here. It's wonderful. Like, I just like hearing them flip from one voice to another. It's just, you're never bored.
Yes, I would agree. And I was going to say, tied into that, it's such a strange juxtaposition because you don't expect a guy who talks like that is going to be this deep thinker, and yet he is. And so you're just expecting to, it almost sounds like a bit from a radio show where they're going to go into some comedy thing, and they don't. It's just, the whole thing is just serious, and it's just, that's the way he talks. Kathy, what are your thoughts on it?
Oh, well, let's save me for later. I want to do some talking about how extraordinary Orson Welles is as a young man who gets this golden ticket after the unexpected uproar of the War of the Worlds to get to do these amazing things. I'd like to hear from Terry.
Okay, Terry.
Well, what I found interesting was how they managed to pull this off. Surely the producers of this program, of this interview, were not the first to notice that there was a connection between Welles and Welles. But the fact that they both happened to be coming to San Antonio, Texas at approximately the same time, within days of each other, I thought was amazing. I've been looking for an explanation for this coincidence, and maybe it's just a coincidence, or maybe someone did invite them both. I don't know. But what I can tell you is that someone did manage, once they were there, to get them both in the studio at KTSA, the San Antonio AM radio station, which still exists today, as is often the case with radio stations. Call letters change. The call letters, these classic historical San Antonio radio call letters, are still around. They've moved from one place to another on the dial. But the fact that they got them together to do this, I thought was terrific. And that they were so natural with each other, because they both had this a great interest in affairs of the world, politics, and so forth. It was, from the perspective of a radio producer, it was an ideal arrangement. And the only other thing I'll say about this is that Orson Welles was very much a self-made man. He was very, very young when he started. He was still very young when this was this interview was produced. But it was as if he had been in the business for, you know, 40, 50 years. He was so natural in dealing with the interview, in dealing with someone who could have been his idol, just as Johnny Carson idolized Jack Benny. But he was just, you know, they were talking as peers, and it made it such a more interesting conversation for that reason. They weren't, you know, one wasn't looking up to the other. And even though H.G. Wells at one point said, you know, I hope someday you'll drop the E from your last name, because it was W-E-L-L-E-S for Orson and without the E for H.G. But apart from, you know, little things like that, they really did speak as colleagues. And I really enjoyed that part of the conversation.
I did too. And the fact that, just like you're saying, Orson is just so spot on. He's the type of person you would just say, oh, if I was casting this, this is what I would want as my other person in the interview going back and forth. Because you could tell H.G. Wells is not that used to being interviewed and everything and feels a little out of his depth, probably. Whereas Orson can just come in and you don't even really need the other interviewer there. Orson could have done the whole thing by himself for sure. And just how gracious Orson is. And when H.G. Wells is trying to plug something that Orson has coming up, which is Citizen Kane, it's like, wow, this is free Citizen Kane. And they're talking about Citizen. This whole interview is just insanely good. But and then Orson says, oh, that's what we call a plug, and explains that a little bit. And I just thought that was really cute. And go ahead.
He talks about some of like the things they're trying and like innovations in film for Citizen Kane. So it's interesting that he even had that, you know, deliberately in his mind doing it. And to this day, everyone still talks about Citizen Kane, and especially the cinematography and the experimental way in which he's making film. It's amazing.
Well, and the one thing we don't talk about that much about Citizen Kane that to us as radio listeners is a big thing was the sound. The sound of Citizen Kane is innovative. You'll have people like, I've talked about before in my podcast, you'll have somebody getting out of a cab or whatever, and it'll be muffled, and then you'll hear them more clearly as the door opens of the cab, just like it would in real life. Whereas on most sets, you hear the person completely clearly no matter what happens, or they go from one room to another and it sounds the exact same. Whereas you'll go into a big room and it'll sound more echoey, and you'll go into a small room and it won't. And all of that has to be thought of and done, because of course the recording piece is very controlled and they don't have to have it sound like reality, and yet they try to, and they do a nice balancing act. Because if you have it sound too much like reality, people are like, what did he say? And I can't, you know, so you got to have that balancing act, making it clear and yet showing the differences. And they do that.
And this is making Citizen Kane in 1940. They didn't have stereo. They had, you know, the equipment was not that spectacular. But just as you all say, just to reiterate, Orson was so young. He was such a self-made man, as you say, Terry. He didn't go to college. He was a sort of star student at a private high school in like somewhere Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Then he set off to see the world. Then he ends up at 22 with the WPA theater troupe in New York doing his African version of Macbeth and the Italian fascist version of Julius Caesar. And so he takes the world by storm. He's doing to earn money. He's doing the Shadow. Mm-hmm. So he's absolutely brilliant, but he's determined to buck the system, to do something unusual. He got so lucky that this sort of crazy thing that was on the Mercury Theater was a sustaining show. It didn't have a sponsor. and it supposedly had like 5% of the market, while Charlie McCarthy was the far and away the highest rated program in 1938. The fact that he was able to take this little show that nobody listened to and do these amazing things sort of thrown together at the last minute got him what I try to explain to my undergraduates is Orson Welles, self-made man, got the golden ticket to go to Hollywood. RKO gave him studio space and said, I'll give you 2 years. You can do anything you want. We're not going to assign you a director. So no one else in the really in the late 30s was getting these opportunities to do what he was able to do. And, you know, if he hadn't picked William Randolph Hearst as a target, he'd have picked somebody else who would have tried to ruin his career. You know, that is just how these things work. But as I said, his very youth. And to tie him back, I love that he also kind of like Johnny Carson, also hugely admired Jack Benny and Fred Allen, right? So after Citizen Kane, when he's looking for work, he's doing Jack Benny's show. Jack was very sick, wasn't that in 1942? Yep. Jack was very sick for a couple of weeks, and they have the young wunderkind Orson Welles and his phalanx of secretaries come in and run the show for a couple of weeks. And then he's also on Fred Allen. And so he's just an extraordinary human being. And it's just sort of a shame that he couldn't keep on. I would have loved to see if more money had been thrown at him, but it was just inevitable. He wasn't going to be able to work within the American media systems.
Yeah.
No. And every once in a while, somebody would come up with something and be able to use him usually through the back door, and he would make something marvelous out of it. I think the most famous, probably late version of that is probably Touch of Evil that he created. He was on as an actor, and Charlton Heston, there's a great interview with Charlton where he's talking about it. And Charlton Heston says, well, we lost our director, didn't have a director, and they were searching for a director, and they're talking to me. And I'm going, well, you know, Orson's like in the movie. Has anybody thought about approaching him? And then he's like, on the other end of the line, there's like dead silence for like 10 seconds. And then they're like, yeah, I guess we could do that. And so they approach him. And of course, Orson throws out the script, says, I'll do it. I'll take it. And you don't even have to pay me any more money. I'll just take what you're going to pay me as the act, you know, what you already agreed to was my fee. But I get to rewrite the entire script and redo the whole thing. And they're like, you got 10 days. And so he's like, okay. And so in 10 days, he rewrites the entire thing. It becomes a completely different movie. Charlton Heston's like, he did exactly what I was hoping he would do, which is to take this and to elevate it to a whole nother level. And the whole beginning establishing shot of that film is a crane shot that lasts like 10 minutes. I don't know. It's a long piece. And it's the longest crane shot anybody's ever done. No one thought it was even possible to do that. And yet he pulls it off as one smooth move. And that whole, if you just listen to how they create that first 10 minutes, it's just insane. The things that he had to do where, you know, it's falling, it goes into the car, it's in the car. Now they have to have the car and not have a windshield and so forth so that they can actually do the shot with the actors in from a crane going backwards. It's like, oh my gosh. But anyway.
If you want a great sort of like imagining a great piece of what Orson Welles was like behind the scenes in his prime, there's a movie that came out not too long ago. It's called Me and Orson Welles. I don't know if you've heard of it, but the parts that have Orson Welles in it, like there's this whole subplot with Zac Efron, but the parts with Orson Welles, it's Christian McKay who plays him. And it is such a great portrayal of Orson Welles, and the voice is spot on. It's amazing.
I've seen pieces of it. I need to watch the whole thing. That would be interesting. Yeah. Well, that's a great stopping point for us. So I think we'll end this one. And
okay. I would like to put in a plug. Let's put in a link for that marvelous episode of Westinghouse One with Ed Murrow, The Night That Spooked America or whatever it was. Thank you for that, which I'd never seen. And it's marvelous. So
yes.
Their attempt at recreating the War of the Worlds broadcast. And I love that it took two human actors to be one Orson Welles.
Orson Welles, yes. Yes, that's interesting. Well, and we're going to go right to that now anyway. So we're going to shut off and go right there.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Charles C. Shaw speaking. KTSA is honored this evening by the presence in our studios of two great men, the Honorable H.G. Wells, world-famous British historian, author, and student of world affairs, and Mr. Orson Welles, the genius of stage, screen, and radio. This is the first time that Mr. H.G. Wells and Mr. Orson Welles have appeared together. In fact, they met for the first time only yesterday here in San Antonio. But this is not the first time that their names have been linked. 2 years ago, Mr. Orson Welles adapted Mr. H.G. Wells' book, War of the Worlds, for radio purposes. And you know the rest. Revising the story somewhat, Mr. Orson Welles depicted an invasion of the United States by men from Mars. Although he explained it numerous times during the program that it was fictitious, the country at large was frightened almost out of its wits. Men called radio stations offering to enlist against the Martians. Others were panic-stricken. The realism of the production, frightening though it was a tribute to Mr. Orson Welles' genius. And thus the name of Welles, H-G-W-E-L-L-S and Orson W-E-L-L-E-S, became linked. Mr. H.G. Wells, in the opinion of many, is the world's most famous man of letters. He has come to San Antonio to address the United States Brewers Association, and Mr. Orson Welles is here for a town hall forum address Wednesday. In this meeting of great minds, I feel rather inconspicuous, and the less I have to say, the better you listeners will like it. But first, could I interest you gentlemen in a discussion of Mr. Orson Welles' broadcast of Mr. H.G. Wells' book, The War of the Worlds?
Are you turning the meeting over to us, sir?
I am for the moment.
He's turning it over to us. Well, I've had a series of the most delightful experiences since I came to America. But the best thing that has happened so far is meeting my little namesake here, Orson. I find him the most delightful carrier. He carries my name and an extra E that I hope he'll drop sooner or later. See no sense in it. And I've known his work before he made this sensational Halloween spree. Are you sure there was such a panic in America, or wasn't it your Halloween fun?
I think that's the nicest thing that a man from England could possibly say about the men from Mars. Well, because Mr. Hitler made a good deal of sport of it, you know, and actually spoke of it in the Great Munich speech, you know. And there were floats in Nazi parades.
Much else to say.
That's right. There isn't much else to say. And it's supposed to show the corrupt condition and decadent state of affairs in democracies that the War of the Worlds went over as well as it did. I think it's very nice of Mr. Wells to say that not only I didn't mean it, but the American people didn't mean it.
That was our impression in England. We had articles about it, and people said, have you never heard of Halloween in America when everybody pretends to see ghosts?
Well, there was some excitement caused. I really can't belittle the amount that was caused, but I think that the people got over it very quickly, don't you?
What kind of excitement? Mr. H.G. Wells wants to know if the excitement wasn't the same kind of excitement that we extract from a practical joke in which somebody puts a sheet over his head and says, boo, I don't think anybody believes that that individual is a ghost, but we do scream and yell and rush down the hall. And that's just about what happened.
That's a very excellent description.
You aren't quite serious in America yet. You haven't got the war right under your chins, and the consequence is you can still play with ideas of terror and conflict.
You think that's good or bad?
It's a natural thing to do until you're right up against it.
So it ceases to be a game.
And then it ceases to be a game.
Well, now, here's a thought. Some of Mr. H.G. Wells' writings are termed fantastic, and a few years ago, well might they have been conceived such. The shape of things to come, which told of a long internecine war, was such a fantasy. But Mr. Orson Welles, do you think that it's so fantastic in view of today's events?
It certainly is not so fantastic, and the one question that Mr. Wells has spoken of, not only in the shape of things to come, but has hinted at or directly prophesied such a state of affairs following a wasting war and a return to a feudalism from which the world would find itself again And today in Mr. Wells's lecture, he said quite the most interesting thing that I've heard in a long time. He said that he commenced just recently to ask himself if there was any reason why mankind should so emulate the phoenix and should so get itself out of its mess. He proposed a couple of solutions, but he did admit that there was a possible excuse for a gloomy point of view, mm-hmm. and that it would be good to be realistic about it and not to dismiss the gloomy point of view anymore. Perhaps the time had come to look ahead, since the future, Mr. Wells' future, which we've always adored and never really understood, is suddenly upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living right now in that famous H.G. Wells future, which we all knew about.
Now, before we get away from this microphone, tell me about this film of yours that you've been producing. Your producer, aren't you? Your
That's right.
Art director, your everything.
Well, Mr. Wells...
What's the film called?
It's called Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yes. Citizen. Not C-A-I-N.
No, K-A-N-E. And this Kane. Is, of course, the kindest and most gracious possible thing to do. Mr. Wells is making it possible for me to do what in America is spoken of as a plug. And he understands
do
this fine old American.
I don't understand these words. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You understand the value, however. Mr. Wells wants me to tell you that I have made a motion picture, and he is kind enough to ask me a leading question concerning it.
I am looking forward to it.
You're very kind, sir. It's a new sort of motion picture with a new method of presentation and a few new technical experiments, a few new methods of telling a picture, not only from the point of view of writing, but of showing it.
If I don't misunderstand you completely, I think there'll be a lot of jolly good new noises in it.
I hope so. I think a few jolly good new noises are what the motion pictures could well afford these days. I hope you're right, and I hope there are some jolly good new noises. I can think of nothing more desirable in motion picture. I'm all for some jolly good new noises.
Wasn't it you, Mr. Orson Welles, that presented for the first time in modern times plays without scenery and settings in your
That's
Julius
right,
Caesar?
That's right, yes. And they were not...
Well, now...
There's no such
yes.
thing as a play without settings, because there's
now,
got to be something behind an actor, and you've got to look at something.
Very simple settings. I had an extraordinary experience once. I saw Ellen Terry's son, what was his name?
Ellen Terry's son?
Yes, his production of Hamlet.
You mean Gielgud?
No.
Gielgud is a relation of the Terrys.
No. Never mind his name for the moment, but I saw Hamlet produced in Russian in Moscow.
Oh, the Stanislavski production, was
no,
it?
No, the...
This I know nothing about.
I'm sorry.
Awfully sorry.
Well, yes. And that was done with screens, don't you know,
That's
nothing
right.
else. And it was done in Russian. I know my Hamlet pretty well, and all the time I thought I was listening to the English play. Do you understand
that?
Yes. That was a great show.
What do you think what effect do you think this war, or any war, will have or is having on the arts, principally the theater and literature?
Well... Now, in a country that is fighting hard, as Britain is doing, the arts go into a temporary rest. But I think if we come out of the war, then there will be a great renaissance, because we shall have a greater sense of reality, less respect, don't you know, for tradition, and the old-fashioned way of looking at things.
Oh, I agree so much.
I think it may. It means...
Great purge, I think.
If it doesn't mean disaster, this war, it means a tremendous renaissance of the human mind.
And a new approach to realities in terms of the arts. Of course, now in America, we go through the worst possible stage in the arts, because we are not ourselves engaged in the war, and the war is only a kind of conception in the newspapers for us. But it has affected us sufficiently to degrade the taste, and we're going through that period during mild war hysteria, which means a degradation of standards in the arts, particularly in the theater arts, but a tremendous boom in the financial aspects thereof. As if people are rushing into the theaters, but they're rushing into the wrong theaters to see the worst kind of pap. Mm-hmm. After we get into the war, and if we do, and after we get into the kind of trouble that we're bound to get into if it isn't precisely the war that we're speaking of now, since the war becomes a new war every week. But after we get into whatever it is we're going to get into, the same thing will be true of us, I think. And our arts will go into a temporary decline. But again, any sort of success following this war must make a whole new approach to the arts possible. It's always a great purge, I think, in the visual arts and in the theater arts, particularly in letters.
What happens to our democratic peoples is first is the shock.
Yes.
And then after the shock, they pull themselves together.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had the shock, and now I hope we're going to pull ourselves together. And that means politics, war, art, everything become more rational, more powerful. We should take a step forward, unless we take a step backward and go over the precipice.
Do you think that that shock is due to a lack of discipline in a democratic country as opposed to a totalitarian country?
Oh, no.
Good. so great.
Discipline is a word for children and, people who have to salute and that sort of thing. Grown-up people do want to live freely and largely. Therefore, any group of gangsters who get together and give themselves wholly up to getting power have a temporary advantage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've been through the whole of this thing on a small scale with your gangsters here who've had for a time a reign of terror. They terrorized.
And a very real discipline in their own ranks.
Yes.
Discipline
is
the word. Mm-hmm. Law of the pack.
Fear discipline in their own ranks. But directly your democracy said, this is too serious and we can't let it go at that. You dealt with them. We have to deal with this air assault on civilization now, because it all comes through the air, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And until we've got a world control of the air, this sort of thing may come back. That's the thing that we have to stop.
Well, do you think that this faculty that makes people get shocked, or this trait that makes them get shocked, is a sign of adulthood as compared with a more childlike attitude on the part of those who are under totalitarian rule?
I think adult people want to live their own lives, try experiments with life, do this and that and the other thing. And therefore, any sort of criminal who chooses to concentrate on terrorism gets a temporary advantage. And you can't cure that. The grown-up world is at the mercy of the criminal until you've developed a method of dealing with the criminal. But a method can be developed.
Naturally, there's a momentary period of surprise, because we're not, by the very nature of our way of life, we're not equipped to deal with what is foreign to our conception of a way of life. So that the first shock must necessarily be very great.
If you have a happy village of people doing this, that, and the other thing, and you get a dangerous lunatic who begins to go about terrorizing the whole village, it's a great nuisance, but you have to pull yourselves together and suppress that lunatic. That's what civilization has to do now.
And for a moment, speaking of your business as a shock, for a moment, of course, there is everybody is merely appalled. And and during that period of mere shock and mere terror, the criticisms against democracy sound very valid indeed. But we know that Mr. Wells' community is going to pull itself together and going to deal with this lunatic.
Well, do you think, Mr. H.G. Wells, that Britain's reverses, early reverses, may have been due to that initial period of shock, and that now they're over
I it? I think that our people could not believe that a whole nation could grow so mad as the Nazi socialists did. Mm-hmm. And therefore they said, poor dears, they must be dreadfully distressed about something. Give them something. Appease them. What is the trouble? But you see, the more they appease, the more frightful the attack.
Because you can't appease paranoia. Every psychiatrist in the world, in any court of law, can tell you that the way to deal with paranoia is not by appeasement. And but we didn't have any psychiatrists in power politics at the time. We simply had sort of goodwill and futile humanistic.
Mm-hmm. Well,
this thing has to be settled now. It has to be. The one dread that I have is appeasement. Some attempt now to call this fight off before it's fairly finished. You back up the British because we can beat the National Socialist. We don't want a single American to die as an American soldier in Europe. But don't get in the way when it comes to a settlement. Don't let them off, because this has to be a decisive fight. And at the end, we've got to have all the world disarmed so far as the air goes, because there'll be no peace until there's a complete control of the air by the civilized forces in the world.
Who do you include as among the civilized nations, Mr. Milton?
Well, the three nations that can put over peace in the air at the present time are America, the British system, and Russia. And if you can make friends with Russia, Russia's a very difficult, fickle country, and you may find a lot of difficulty in making friends. But if you can work somehow with the Russian, then you can now make peace in the air for all time.
Wouldn't you have to appease Russia?
Why appease Russia?
Why appease Russia? She's
I don't understand such a question.
Well, to recognize her conquests.
What conquests?
Of the Baltic countries and Finland.
Listen, wait a minute.
Listen to that. We English have had a lesson about that. We let the Germans push their airports right up to the English Channel. We let them put guns that can fire into Dover. We had our time over again. We should certainly have bombed Berlin when we were right up on the French frontier. And we should have taught them the mischief of trying to make war in somebody else's country. Now, the Russians have done nothing but push back the German bases so that they can't do a blitzkrieg on Moscow.
This has been misrepresented as imperialism, which is, of course, absurd, because if Russia was bound for imperialism, which is inconceivable anyway, considering the internal economy of Russia, they certainly would have behaved in a very different way.
How would America behave if you had guns commanding the approach to New York on Staten Island, if you had a brave little foreign country in New Jersey, if you had Nazi bases creeping up through the French colonies, creeping up through South America, so that presently it would be quite an easy job to bomb New York. Would America wait for it? Is America waiting for it today? No. What you are doing as fast as you can is pushing back any possibility of getting bomber planes over America.
By that you refer to our air bases in the Caribbean and the Atlantic?
Yes, and in preventing any settlement of an air base anywhere that can threaten. That's the obvious policy. Have the Russians done any worse than that? Aren't the English now bitterly repenting of the fact that they didn't bomb Berlin when they could have bombed Berlin quite easily, and that they've allowed the German bases to creep forward so that every night we get the raiders over the mouth of the Thames and that sort of thing. You see, learn from us. Mm-hmm. If you learn from us, you not only find your own policy clear, but you also see the reason, the good, sound, common sense of the Russian action with regard to the Neva and with regard to the Kursk line.
Well, Mr. Orson Welles, don't you agree that the press and other mediums of public opinion in this country have painted the Russians pretty much villains?
Oh, naturally, and appallingly so.
We should
The foreign correspondents working on American wire services are emotionally unprepared to deal sensibly and in a neutral and decent way about the whole Russian business. And the press represents, for the most part, vested interest in America, and therefore the whole Russian picture has been so falsified as to make it almost impossible to discuss with the ordinary intelligent American the Russian position. It's a great tragedy because perhaps the hope of the world is some sort of alliance with Russia. I'm not speaking of a communist revolution.
Understanding
with the aims of Russia, no matter how much we may quarrel with the administration of the Russian ideal. After all, it's not too foreign from the democratic ideal, but the democratic ideal has chosen to divorce itself from this, and this choice has been made by vested interests, by people who shake with terror at the mere mention of any sort of equity in world affairs.
Well, didn't you say today, Mr. H. G. Wells, that Russia was considerably Tory even yet? They haven't.
You used the word Oriental Toryism, which is a very interesting phrase and needs a good deal of.
But all the same, they have every interest in the world in coming to some arrangement for the suppression of air war. They don't want it. They got much too big a part of the earth to develop themselves, to want territory in Europe.
The administration of the socialist state in Russia is, after all, none of our affair. We may criticize the OGPU, and we may not like the personality or the methods of Mr. Stalin, but the fact remains that there is happening in Russia something which is in the direction of progress. We cannot deny progress. If we do, we step backward, and stepping backward is suicide.
Mr. H. G. Wells, I understand you've written a new book.
Yes, I've...
Very great book.
Put a lot of... Orson's a good fellow.
Sensible, too. Discerning, yes.
Yes.
No, that's true.
Yes, I've tried to do the mental attitude of two very clever young people, two university students, towards the world, how the world looks to them and what problems they have to face. It's a book for the young, about the young.
And it's a very young book.
It's very, thank you.
And what is the name of your book?
I think for a man that I've only met in 2 days, Orson's a very loyal cousin of mine.
What is the name of the book, Mr. Wells? Babes in the
Dorkling... Babes in the Darkling Wood. Not Babes in the Wood, but Babes in the Darkling Wood.
Is it realistic or any fantasy in it?
Oh, no, it's quite realistic. They just talk away at their troubles.
Most of Mr. Wells' novels are realistic, but it's a misconception. It's assumed that a man who could say that the air arm of a country is the most important thing about a country in the future, that such a madman must certainly write nothing but fantasy.
Yes. Well, gentlemen, it's with great reluctance that I have to say our time's up. This has been one of the real pleasures of my life. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to Mr. H.G. Wells, the famous British historian and author, and Mr. Orson Welles, the theatrical genius, who met for the first time in San Antonio yesterday and have honored us with their presence tonight. To you, Mr. H.G. Wells, and to you, Mr. Orson Welles, my heartfelt thanks for your kindness.
KTSA San Antonio, we present.